This recording contains a free selection of chapters from the audiobook Digital Vegan by Dr. Andy Farnell. The full work is approximately 8 hours long and consists of 50 chapters with an extensive bibliography. The book is also available in ebook and printed formats from the website at digitalvegan.net.
A quote from Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville. When the taste for physical gratifications among them has grown more rapidly than their education, the time will come when men are carried away and lose all self-restraint. It is not necessary to do violence to such people in order to strip them of the rights that they enjoy. They themselves willingly will loosen their hold. They neglect their chief business, which is to remain their own masters.
Chapter 1.
Why I am not a vegan.
Summary of chapter.
It's weakness. I am not a vegan. Maybe I wish I had the courage or self-discipline to be. I just like meat too much. It's everywhere. A vast industry exists to sell meat. It would be hard to eat with friends or family without feeling awkward, being the special case that everyone else must make allowances for. Besides, I am weak-minded. On occasions, I've tried being a vegan, but quickly slipped back into meat-feasting addiction, despite my body and mind having felt immeasurably better without it. Worse, I am morally lazy. I know that the meat industry is cruel, that so many animals suffer and die in disgraceful conditions, pumped with antibiotics, antidepressants and hormones. It's so horrible that I block it out with denial, willful ignorance and rationalisation. Right now, our dependency on meat farming is driving planet-wide extinction. In 50 years, wildlife has dropped by two-thirds. 94% of Latin American rainforests have vanished. Meat farming accounts for the overwhelming majority of this. As more species become extinct and ecosystems collapse, there is a cascade effect, extinguishing still more species that depend upon them. Therefore, humans are quite simply eating all animal life on Earth. The consequences of this loss of diversity, including millions of yet undiscovered compounds and medicines, is simply unimaginable. And it's clear that economic, not just moral logic, stacks up in favour of the vegan. We could feed everyone on the planet 10 times over with a fraction of the farmland and carbon production. But it's just too much effort to change, right? So, my apologies to any actual vegans for jumping your train. I salute you. So, like all of us, I could improve my life. I could take more care of myself. I could think about someone else. But I can't stop. Knowing all of this, why can't I stop? For the same reasons that you can't stop. Ask yourself right now, why can't you stop looking at that phone? Why are you probably right now sending data to corporations whose open aim is total cybernetic domination of the Earth's population? Why don't you stop supporting child labour? Why do you contribute to mountains of electronic waste, flooding the Earth with toxic compounds that cause sterility in thousands of species? Why do you buy products designed to be obsolete within a few months? Why do you defer judgment on deeply human affairs to so-called artificial intelligence, which has much less sense than a nematode worm? Why can't you stop enabling oppressive regimes? And why do you tolerate mass surveillance and manipulation? We're not so different. We each do our bit, trying to change the world. I do my bit with computers. Maybe together, by sharing intelligence and goals, we can do better. I'm an ordinary professor who teaches computer science. My specialisation is in signals and systems and cybersecurity. I'm not a food scientist, or an environmental activist, or a health expert. These are simply metaphors that I use. The subject of this book is that of retaking technology, and why, for the same reasons as me, You Can't Stop. It's about why we need a mass movement that takes a different view of technology to the one forced on us by Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, and hundreds of other corporate neo-monopolies that dominate our lives today. To understand technology as nourishing or toxic, a metaphor of dietary health might help us. Like food, we consume technology without thinking about where it comes from and what it is doing to us. As with food, we tend to go along with the crowd. And like food, we rarely distinguish what we think we want from what we actually need. So we overconsume or waste it. By casting our technological problems as digital rights, I think we fall into a trap. People assume that someone else is taking care of those rights. If you knew how few people are active, you would be disappointed. A few ragtag organisations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the World Summit on Information Society, and, in the United Kingdom, the Open Rights Group, are all that stands against a tide of abusive ideologies operating through the giant tech corporations. Bruce Schneier keeps an impressive-looking list of technologists in the public interest on his website. I wish it gave me more hope, but they do look like a typical slice of white American academia, all of whom could be bought with the loose change in Google's pocket. So politically, we're in a rather poor situation. There is almost no intelligent public debate around technology. Mass media and social media avoid the issues because to engage would be to question their own platform. Few, if any, politicians understand or care about these issues. Our schools and universities are decades behind. We have no credible projects for civic cybersecurity or public education on these digital issues. As democracy itself comes under threat, our problems are growing too big and fast for the current vanguards to counter. Corporate cybercriminals escape justice, while civic-minded hackers and whistleblowers who take a lonely stand are severely punished. Public officials, including prime ministerial advisers, have called for the deaths of those who reveal their digital privilege and manipulations, while others are exiled or imprisoned without trial. This should tell you a lot about how the powerful are invested in their project of mass technological control. But slowly, we are awakening. In 1962, marine biologist Rachel Carson woke us up to the lethal pollutants in her book, Silent Spring. In 1972, systems theorist Dana Meadows blew the lid on the fundamental unsustainability of human growth in her book, The Limits to Growth. These scientists and many others since have had 50 years for their ideas to be taken into the mainstream. Environmental science reigns supreme in public focus today. In 2013, Edward Snowden told us just how rotten our communications and computer systems really are. His book, Permanent Record, is the silent spring or limits to growth of our generation. But this knowledge has not yet been processed by our culture. It has not even sunk in, let alone started to have effects. There are not yet mass movements to break up tech monopolies, dismantle the overreaching intelligence agencies, mandate interoperable standards, and help people to use unbreakable encryption and protect their privacy and dignity online. But there should be. And we need to start somewhere. In this book, I'll try not to be a judgmental, sanctimonious, preaching, frightened, dramatic, attention-seeking, or disingenuous writer. However, I want you to read the rest of this book with some urgency, and I want it to change your life. Hopefully, you will become a digital vegan too, because I believe all of our futures depend on it.
Chapter 2.
Hatsland.
Summary of chapter.
People aren't wearing enough hats. A quote from Rousseau's Second Discourse on Inequality, 1755. All ran headlong for their chains, in the belief that they were securing their liberty. One day, a friend of yours is wearing a hat. It doesn't really suit her, but you make a compliment all the same. A few weeks later, another friend is wearing a similar hat. Maybe she copied her. Before long, all the hat crowd are hanging out together, and soon you notice it's happening to people everywhere. The hat craze, like the Rubik's Cube or the Harlem Shake, is out of the bag. You guess it will blow over, like all crazes do, maybe within a year. But it doesn't. Soon, people start pressuring you. Don't you like hats, Kate? No. As it happens, this new craze is for ugly and impractical hats. They are undignified. Soon, medical evidence grows that they make your hair fall out, after which you need to have a hat. Some people try giving up their hats, but they feel naked. They soon end up back with a hat. Then it starts to get weird. Men in suits feel that people aren't wearing enough hats. Millions of hats, mass-produced by slaves, flood the world. The dignity of being hat-free, of exercising taste, becomes a social stigma. One day, while riding on the bus, you notice that everybody has a hat, and they're all staring at you, murmuring. Through the window, you swear you see Donald Sutherland, agape, pointing at you. Before long, they won't even let you on the bus without a hat. Bars and restaurants refuse non-hat wearers. A breathless press and government stooges, and even teachers at schools, start to talk about how hats are absolutely vital to our way of life now. All of this happens in just a few years, following millennia of happily hatless human civilization. For a while, living as a bareheaded refusenik in Hatland is still possible. You can carry on with a normal life, so long as you do not interact with others. Apartheid against the unhatted is soon open policy, and the police profile people without hats. Insults and exclusion become a daily experience. Everybody knows that the Ministry of Haberdashery, chaired by the Mad Hatter, are rolling out mandatory hat fitting and that hat re-education camps are being built.
Chapter 4.
Your brain on tech.
Summary of chapter.
Hiding your light. No doubt persists that smartphones and social media are rewiring our brains, causing serious negative effects. The structure and neurological composition of our brains is changing. It's affecting our personal relationships, causing depression, loneliness, impacting social relationships across society. Parallels have been drawn to tobacco, alcoholism, and gambling, leading to demands for regulation. See references 11 through 16. One symptom is antisocial behaviour, manifest as passive or overt aggression towards even temporary disconnection. People absorbed by technology are not merely oblivious to others. Some measure of entitlement rides along with it. Dare I say, a whiff of active malice? I've seen that look, and almost willing everybody else not to exist, that's in the corner of the amused, passive-aggressive smirk a smartphone zombie displays on encountering his mortal enemy. Mild inconvenience. When reality dares to intrude, if, for example, needing to step an inch to the side of an oncoming car or pedestrian, the smombi is indignant. Inhabiting a private fantasy world, like a four-year-old, is not a wakeful or connected state. Researchers have even coined the term nomophobia to describe anxious aggression, moodiness, and outbursts caused by separation or a fear of separation from smartphones. See reference 17. So, to the extent that we are more connected, an ironic reversal of that word occurs. Connected really means half asleep or zombified, hypnotized by the narcotic anodyne of what is, in his 1993 book Technopoly, what Neil Postman called our surrender of culture to technology, our electronically altered brain states. Unlike the short-lived effects of television, continuous connection to social media exerts a persistent spell over its victim. It overlays an alternate reality on the mundane daily world, one that occupies your attention thoughts and feelings, even after the phone is switched off. Some years ago, one of my master's degree students, researching the use of mobile tech in public, well, she was actually investigating hearing loss. But in our tutorial, we discussed some very interesting, unexpected findings, specifically that women admitted to wearing headphones and staring into smartphones as a barrier, especially in those places like the Tube in London's subway system, to send a not approachable signal to potential pests. One of the interviewees said that she felt it was like wearing a mask or a hat. To me, this was like a whiff of gunpowder or a speck of blood at a murder scene. It was a clue to the psychophilosophical puzzle that I've been assembling for 30 years, that there is much more to technology than we think, more than the official narrative of convenient connectedness. Recently, as I walked past a lad throwing litter in the street, we had a strange interaction. He saw that I saw what he did. And immediately he reached into his pocket, pulled out a phone and hid in it. His shame and fear and avoidance could hardly have been more obvious if he had run off and hidden behind a nearby tree. Technology, in this sense, is a way of disconnecting, of putting up barriers, of excluding everything that cannot be brought under the infantile control of a finger swipe. Therefore, like the word progress and other unqualified abstract nouns, the ideas of connectedness and awareness need re-examining. We must ask, aware of what? Connected to what? What in actual reality rather than as a vague illusion? A failure in our digital age is poor discrimination amongst data, noise, information, useful information, understanding, and wisdom. We are still in so much awe and culture shock from the past 30 years that we have not sincerely asked, what is all this connection for?
Chapter 8.
Finding the words.
Summary of chapter.
Silence, please. Students, I know, in their 20s, who should be at the peak of neurological acuity, are sometimes barely able to speak. Since Taylor Marley wrote Speaking with Conviction, that wonderful poem on the most aggressively inarticulate generation to come along since, you know, a long, long time ago, things got much worse. See reference 32. Marley implied that our youth are gagged by a pervading sense of relative worth, a fear of peer judgment, like tall poppy syndrome or Jante law. He urged us to speak with confidence. But confidence is not the issue. We've had two United States presidents whose confident speech is indistinguishable in content from a drunk. The function of speech has changed. Unintelligibility became a virtue, dumbing down speech to a non-threatening, cute, folksy fuddle is now fashionable for populist leaders. For example, Tony Blair tried to play the, like, you know, guitar-strumming student dude. Today, speech is not used for its content qua words, to construct arguments or engage in dialogical reason, but to send metaverbal signals. The British statesman Disraeli spoke from a different age when he said, "Men govern with words." Mastery of clear language, once considered a core leadership skill, when deployed by one with such forthright character as the environmentalist Greta Thunberg, is now mocked by senior statesmen who pout and preen on the world stage. See reference 33. A mistake would be to imagine that George Bush, Donald Trump, Tony Blair, or any of the scriptwriters, psychologists, and researchers that create them are stupid. No, Every word is chosen carefully. That should be terrifying, because it tells us that every word is perfectly tuned to the tone and comprehension level of the average person. Alarmingly, inarticulate, fumbling, and scattered speech clearly correlates with mobile digital technology use and with the distracted, anxious, and poorly socialized state of mind it creates. Aside from some neurological conditions, brain injuries, strokes, and stammering, which break the flow of speech, our thought processes are closely linked to speech. When speech falters in otherwise healthy people, it is usually a sign that inner thought is failing. So it should be no surprise that tech giant billionaires forbid their own children from using social media and send them to schools without technology. What is behind this? Do they know something that we don't? Paul Lewis, writing in The Guardian, thinks so, describing the tech insiders who fear a smartphone dystopia. See reference 34. He wonders, what do they know? Or does the transition from a reading culture to an iconic visual culture reduce intelligence? Is it the brevity of Twitter? Or is it the distancing effect, the echo chambers? Whatever the cause, I notice an ever-widening intelligence gulf between those who are free of social media and smartphones and those who are habitual users. Of course, people vary in relative capacity for focus. What the philosopher Heidegger called Sorge, while discussing the question of technology, see reference 35, is all about one's goals or one's care, one's plan or major concern in life. Like Sorge, the Japanese call it ikigai, and perhaps in French we would say raison d'être, an organizing principle or purpose in life. The word calling is sometimes used in English, but in Western life the concept is more feeble or even absent for many of us, swept along by a stream of digital distractions. Similarly, Nietzsche, in his Will to Power, regarded an element of unwavering authenticity or self-creative drive as essential to a well-lived life. See reference 36. Practitioners of mindfulness understand, as Liam Neeson's Star Wars character Qui-Gon advised the young Obi-Wan, your focus determines your reality. See reference 37. That internal voice which narrates our lives is fragile, so easily drowned by the chatter of technology. To speak with confidence, we must each be able to hear our own soul.
Chapter 9.
Digital Child Abuse.
Summary of chapter.
Never let school get in the way of your education. In the 21st century, a new word, cyberbullying, emerged to describe employing communication technology to conduct psychological abuse. Workplace cyberbullying is an adult problem, and I have tried to cover this elsewhere. But what is extraordinary and preventable is how many children are affected. 70% of children become victims of cyberbullying at some time. Most are young girls. A sickening slew of teenage suicides has made the headlines. The problem increases year on year since 2005. At the heart of this problem is forced identity. Skeptics of the teenage suicide epidemic, linked to social media, say that school children have always bullied one another. Of course, that is true. Traditionally, when children got bullied, they fought back or told their parents, who took them out of school until the issue was resolved. What is different today is that children are forced to occupy adult-free digital spaces to form social hierarchies and self-organize in a brutal ecosystem where popularity, success, and normativity are wielded as weapons against fragile psyches. We might assume that, as in William Golding's 1954 book Lord of the Flies, see reference 38, a degenerate cruelty must emerge. In reality, as reported in The Guardian of May the 9th, 2020, see reference 39, the real Lord of the Flies turned out quite differently. When a group of children were cast away on a Tongan atoll in 1977, they built human relations that put modern conceits of civilization to shame. When computer kiosks are set up in villages of developing countries, spectacular cooperation, self-organization, and autodidactic capacity, kind mentoring of each other, takes place amongst children. Katrine McMillan, the founder of Projects for All, has set up such self-organizing schools around the world. Her work is inspired by experiments conducted by educational pioneer Sugata Mitra on minimally invasive education technology, see reference 40, which has changed the way we need to think about technology in schools. In the West, we have it all wrong. We force technology upon kids, often assuaging our own anxieties that they will be left behind otherwise. And it's the worst kind of technology, designed by massive edutech companies that aim to collect data, profile our children, and make life easier for teachers. In these digital cages, they have no prospect of really educating themselves. And when it comes to self-determination and the real rules of digital citizenship, they have no prospect of fighting back. Any child understands that, in reality, they can punch a bully and put a decisive end to persecution. Indeed, many parents and teachers would hold that this physicality is the only real solution, even though modern societal pretenses and norms prevent us from publicly saying so. But what is a 10-year-old to do against digitally mediated victimisation? How can they cope with being in a network that is much too big and hostile? It's the digital equivalent of being abandoned on the streets of New York City. If a little school child knew how to run exploits against her persecutors' phones, to DDoS their home networks, to plant evidence and wipe her enemies' devices, well then, it would be a very different matter. What if she knew how to configure firewall rules on her device to block Microsoft from spying on her? But not many kids have parents whose first instinct is to teach them how to hack back. So where are the grown-ups here? Tragically, they are entirely absent. When I first read of young girls killing themselves because of harassment on Facebook, I could not really understand. Why did they simply not disconnect? As a user of first wave social media from about 1990, I probably spent thousands of hours using internet relay chat or other messenger systems, including those within multiplayer game communities. The important difference between first wave peer communication technology and today's centralized corporate systems is that we all had ephemerality and anonymity. That's what made it safe. More than a mere question of scale, prior to about 2005, peer communications were qualitatively different to social media today. Sure, some people published their real names and home phone numbers in Usenet posts. Others had completely fictitious identities. Most people had several and they used them for different purposes. If things got nasty, you just deleted your avatar or quit a channel. And the next day, you created a new identity. The plurality of services and ability to disconnect at will by simply dumping a digital identity is something I believe is very important to how we as humans should use communication technology healthily. During my formative use of peer communications, I had many dozens of online identities. Why can young people no longer do this? This isn't a question about behaviour and anonymity. There are many psychological theories that seek to explain how anonymity breeds cruelty and contempt, and just as many that reveal that anonymity is the core of honesty, generosity, and altruism. See references 41 through 43. But to understand why a war has been waged against anonymity and ephemerality, the qualities that can make children safe from online bullies, and adults from stalkers and predatory corporations alike, just look to who benefits. The enemies of anonymity are those who financially benefit from tracking people online and exploiting their personal data. Schools, if they wish to use technology in the classroom, have absolutely no need to use real identities. Yet they are pressured by ill-conceived policy forged by the lobbyists of corporate power. By forcing people to become invested in digital identities, they can be controlled. Interestingly, this phenomena emerged in massively multiplayer online role-playing games, so-called MMORPGs, like the game EVE Online, where digital currencies were used to create an attachment investment in a digital identity, and thus get people hooked and get them coming back to play the game. Recall from an earlier chapter that there is a multi-billion dollar industry committed to ensuring that digital users are tagged with a permanent identity. Advertisers will do anything to track and profile users, including overtly criminal acts of hacking, fingerprinting, and infiltrating the phones of minors. One of the masterstrokes has been to convince politicians that tying devices to real identities makes children safer. I can't stress enough what a crock of crap that is, and how foolish or corruptible our politicians are if taken in by it. It does nothing but make phone users more profitable to surveillance capitalism. And, as a side effect, it places young people at more risk. Today, parents give smartphones to kids who sign up to Facebook and other social sites using their actual real names. Schools give laptops to kids and create accounts using the child's real identity. In my opinion, as a cybersecurity worker, this is absolutely unforgivably bad operational security. To put it as mildly as possible, it shows that the teachers and school ICT workers know absolutely nothing about technology or the world that we live in. In one case in the UK, a 10-year-old girl was pretty much killed by her school laptop. Despite her mother doing everything possible to isolate her daughter from ongoing cyberbullying by confiscating her smartphone, the girl still had a school-issued laptop, which her mum felt that she could not take away from her child. A school giving a 10-year-old a Google Chromebook with all of its security holes and having open internet access and Facebook is grotesquely irresponsible. I'd say that parents in that situation ought to make it perfectly clear to the child's school that unless they make immediate provisions to continue teaching using paper and pen alternatives, that they will be seeing the inside of a courtroom. Cover any risk of financial liabilities by giving them written notice that if your child comes home with the laptop again, it will be going straight into the recycling bin. Despite the best efforts of European GDPR to protect children, so-called edutech companies are queuing up to foist their data harvesting technology on our schools. The temptation for advertisers, governments, and manufacturers to gather data on children is irresistible. Data from minors is seen as especially valuable from a psychological profiling and behaviourally predictive point of view. For the predators, there's just one problem. Under our laws, including contract laws and those that guard against pederasty, a child cannot give consent. The rationale is that a child cannot understand the consequences of what they are agreeing to. Because tech giants really, really want this data, parents are therefore put under extraordinary pressure. The mainstream media normalise premature overconnection. Selling phones to children is big business, and newspapers and TVs do not want to upset their advertisers. Overworked teachers want things to be easy, so schools pick cheap, convenient products without thought for the long-term consequences. And parents succumb to their own desire to micromanage and control their children using technology, mistakenly thinking that they are protecting them. Finally, there is a great confusion around the wish to teach children digital literacy, which smartphones and crap from Google and Microsoft can never do. In the 1980s, Western governments embarked on ambitious projects of teaching technology in schools. My lucky generation had BBC Micros, and we programmed in BASIC. We are the generation that built the internet and the digital technologies that we have today. For 30 years, though, since 1990, technology education lost its way, regressing to teaching Microsoft Word and Excel spreadsheets. During that era of confusion, an idea arose that any use of technology somehow amounts to technological education. This is a patently idiotic conflation of ideas. A sad vestigial sentiment remains in the air that it's good for kids to have computers in schools because it teaches them modern technology. But being taught by technology is not the same as being taught technology. So children who cannot give informed consent are betrayed by all their ostensible guardians, because we really have another, bigger problem. By the same token, the vast majority of adults, including parents and teachers, school boards and education ministers, are utterly out of their depth and unable to make informed choices in this area. Technology is becoming a cargo cult. One of the reasons we are stuck is that schools are inducting new generations into passive techno-normativity. So one important step towards positive change is removing unnecessary technology from schools. Presently, our understanding about children and technology are woefully inadequate in law, in social norms, in policies, and in knowledge of the long-term effects. I think we may look back at the early 21st century in horror, as we now think of Victorians who sent their children up chimneys or into cotton mills, thinking that it was character building. Again, my advice to parents at this point is teach your children technology. Do not let technology teach your children. Outside of computer programming and technology classes, just say no. Wherever possible, opt out of routine usage of classroom technology. Remember that Silicon Valley billionaires do not let their children be taught by computers at school. Your child will not be left behind. There is nothing they will miss out on that cannot be learned through real-world interactions. Educational technology at the primary and grade school level is overrated. They will pick it up at an appropriate age. And so to the second important step. Even better, help them learn for themselves. Teach your children to hack. Teach them to be brutally critical. Teach them their digital roots and how to get root. And if you cannot, at least step aside and give them the encouragement to be curious and break boundaries for themselves. They have nothing left to lose but the approval of a society with nothing left to offer them. Help them to be the digital Rosa Parks of their generation, who will challenge domination and overthrow it. If you don't have the courage to do that, then at least be honest with them that it's you who are scared and ignorant. Maybe then they will find a way out of digital enslavement on their own, if they feel backed up by their parents.
Chapter 42.
Free or Libre Software.
Summary of chapter.
Eat yourself fitter. For a digital vegan, Libre Software, also called Free Software, is the organic whole food store of technology. Libre Software respects freedoms and enables user communities to defend against being controlled by companies. The strength lies not only in the software design and its license, but the community that forms around it. That does not mean that Libre Software can't be used to do harm. Indeed, all of the tech giants are built upon Libre Software. But it affords you and others important rights to examine and change the code. It ensures other developers are free to compete and offer better technology that respects your dignity. It therefore supports the true spirit of the competitive market and works against monopoly power. The original culture of software was such that people freely shared it, much like poetry or recipes. Companies selling software obtained laws that made program code subject to copyright. Libre software is generally recognized to have begun with the GNU, GNU operating system, an alternative to proprietary operating systems like Microsoft Windows. Since the mid-1980s, users and developers of GNU software have been active advocates of free software, forming a powerful movement that has changed the world and done wonders to advance computer science and popular technology alike. The Free Software Foundation, the FSF, an organization created by computer scientist Richard Stallman, who also launched GNU, strongly promotes software freedom. In the early 1990s, Finnish hacker Linus Torvalds created a vital missing component, a kernel called Linux, which enabled the GNU operating system to run more widely. Though many variants exist, a popular Libre operating system is called Debian. It was founded by Ian Murdoch and Deborah Lynn, its name being a composite of their forenames, Debbie and Ian. And it extols the credo of Libre software through the documents by Bruce Perrins, which create a social contract between developers and users. These set out the egalitarian basis of a software lineage that now includes Ubuntu amongst its many progeny. Google's own Android operating system also uses the Linux kernel. Though while Linux is a component shared by Android and GNU, Android is a locked down and proprietary operating system, whereas GNU is true Libre software. If you read into this subject a little more, you'll see that basically many of these large tech companies take free software and then restrict it or lock it down by adding their own proprietary rules to it. And in many ways, this is entirely parasitical. Some large companies give code back to the free software community, but decreasingly so, and often with onerous restrictions applied to their so-called charity. Software freedom is therefore promoted and protected by the mechanism of copyleft. What makes copyleft software clever is that, like the martial art of Aikido, it uses the enemy's strengths against him. The enemy is a victim of greed. Being selfish and unjust, he wants to restrict the way that people use computers and software. And as we've discussed before, in modern digital technology, money is no longer made by providing enabling services so much as imposing restrictions and coercing the way that you use software in order for the suppliers to extract value from the users. But unlike a tangible good, all code is reproducible infinitely and for zero cost. This eliminates the scarcity criterion on which capitalism rests. Therefore, profit is obtained by stopping us from cooperating and sharing knowledge. Now, copyright asserts that symbolic representations of ideas can be owned. Thus, it seems to rescue a corrupt version of capitalism through creating contrived scarcity. Using copyright, licenses may be applied to software, which then control the behaviour of anybody using it. Licensing in itself is uncontroversial. It's a facet of contract law, respected by almost everybody. However, proprietary software usually comes with onerous licenses which restrict the user's basic freedoms to run programs as they wish, to copy, study, modify, and redistribute them. So, Richard Stallman's GNU project executes an audacious masterstroke and repurposes copyright by writing a copyleft license called the GNU General Public License, the GPL, which sets out contractual conditions not to restrict freedoms, but instead to enforce them. Like Rousseau, Stallman compels us to be free. The GPL says that you can only use or redistribute software if you respect its four freedoms. Let's examine these four freedoms. Firstly, You have the freedom to run the program as you please for any purpose. Secondly, you have the freedom to study the program and modify it to work as you like. Thirdly, you have the freedom to redistribute the program with anyone so long as you afford them the same rights. And fourthly, you have the freedom to redistribute modified versions that afford the same rights. This last freedom is very important. The GPL places obligations to preserve freedom upon distributions of any modified copies. Thus, it is sometimes called a viral license, in that it spreads freedom. So long as Libre software is not damaged by encumbrances such as digital restrictions management, or run on locked down hardware or hardware containing backdoors, it gives broad digital health protections to all users. It allows you to know what your computer is doing, and if you don't like that, to change it, and to make it behave properly, and then to help others benefit from your efforts. In addition to Libre free software, there are other kinds of free software which do not use the copyleft license, such as those based on OpenBSD and NetBSD. These actually offer more secure operating systems than those obtainable with the Linux kernel, partly due to the fact that they are much simpler and better audited in their code base. Both a strength and weakness of free software is that it is sometimes maintained by volunteers who are unpaid. As such, they are less corrupted by power relations, but they also rely on donations and handouts for funding, and are less coordinated in their operations. To some extent, the Free Software Foundation helps with this. Richard Stallman has written extensively on the social philosophy of Libre software, the injustice and societal damages of misusing copyright and patent law in digital technology. His most notable book, forwarded by Lawrence Lessig and Joshua Gay, is the 2002 Free Software, Free Society. See reference 146.
Chapter 45.
Notes from the old school.
Summary of chapter.
When computers were real computers. Retro is fun, fashionable, and effective again. Reusing is always better than recycling. So why not restore and enjoy a classic computer? In December 2020, Chris Wilkinson wrote an article for Ars Technica on working through the pandemic using a 1991 25 MHz Mac Quadra. As a writer, he found it not only effective, but more focused. Each year, your computer seems to get slower. How can that be? Some people think that they get worn out, tired like living creatures or mechanical devices. Apple even took advantage of that fallacy by sending updates to deliberately slow down their older models and make people buy new ones. But computers do not get slower. Software gets slower. Software is the only industry whose product gets less efficient every year. The, quote, need for ever more processing power is an illusion. Moore's law provides a glut of processing power, so programs that perform simple tasks like editing a document or playing a sound file are rewritten to use more processing power as part of a marketing spiral that feeds interlocking hardware and software industries. If this didn't happen, people would simply notice that their computers were good enough and buy no more. A friend of mine was amazed when trying out a 1996 Amiga computer. "How can it run so fast?" he asked. "It's because its software is matched in simplicity and efficiency precisely to its hardware. Many features found on older computer systems, like instant on ROM operating systems, and unbelievable systematic integration found in RISC-OS and Lisp machines, are buried and forgotten in the early 2020s. I am a firm believer that Microsoft set back computing by 20 years with their Windows operating system. It is a textbook counterexample to the mythology of efficient market capitalism, proving that wherever there's money, there's mediocrity. Top-end systems from 30 years ago, made by companies like Atari, Amiga, and Sun Microsystems, can be bought for almost nothing in junk shops, and with USB adapters can be modernized so that you can attach hard disks filled with thousands of incredible programs freely downloadable from the internet. Professional writers around the world still use and love the old WordStar program. My personal preference for writing is Emacs, a program first written in 1976. There are programmers who still write new applications for old hardware, and even in 2020, new peripherals were sold for the Amiga computers. Unless some capacitors need replacing, a job that any electronics engineer can do for you, the hardware is built so well that it will keep on going. If it has lasted for 30 years, it may very well last for another 30. Of course, a trick here is to know a little bit about computers and be realistic about what a vintage computer can do for you. It will not play YouTube videos or run the Google Chrome browser. Consider those as features. On the other hand, neither will it run mountains of crapware that spies on your every move. Programs tend to be much simpler and therefore more usable. They also tend to be modifiable and, on deeper inspection, are more versatile and flexible for a user who wants to learn how to adapt them. A similar thing can be said for older peripherals. Laser printers and scanners from 20 years ago just seem to keep on rocking. And if you're honest with yourself, the quality is good enough. If you can find help setting up and servicing older equipment, it will often outperform and outlast anything available as new today. Classic monochrome laser printers use cheap powdered toner and can print in awesome quality at fractions of a penny per sheet. They will not break when instructed over the internet or leak your sensitive documents to a so-called cloud printing service that you didn't even know was enabled. Sadly, perfectly good old hardware vanishes because we have a culture of gratuitous replacement and little patience. Changing economics of Chinese-made goods plus 3D printing and rapid FPGA design has turned the myth of it being cheaper to replace than to fix things completely on its head. A burgeoning repair and mend movement has now emerged, building information networks, sharing service manuals and 3D printed part specifications to keep hardware running for decades. The electronics industry is absolutely terrified of this and has abused copyright and patent laws. We can beat them. Around the world, a vibrant right to repair culture is now overturning laws bought by tech lobbyists. Opinion is tipping in favour of environmentalism. In response, the corporations try to slyly shift the debate towards so-called safety issues and opine, without any irony, that older equipment poses a cybersecurity threat. On the contrary, with a little care and perhaps a Raspberry Pi as a firewall, older equipment can be made much safer than modern devices which have hidden security holes. This book that you are reading, a PhD thesis, a dozen journal articles, hundreds of student lessons, and three other books since 1991 have all been typed on my Lexmark RS232 keyboard. So far, it's survived 4 house moves, 2 dogs, 3 cats, multiple spilled coffee incidents, and I intend to still be using it in 40 years' time. It's now connected to a Raspberry Pi 4 running BSD. Old and new technology can work in perfect harmony.
This book is also available in ebook and printed formats from the website at digitalvegan.net. The full work is approximately 8 hours long and consists of 50 chapters with an extensive bibliography.